The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 22, March 12, 2006. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I'd like to remind the listeners how to get in touch with me. You can do so via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, the website www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, by calling the listener comment line at area code 206-337-0888. You can also go to the MySpace page that was created just a little while ago, but already there's 162 friends on it. To get to that, go to www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast, or you can go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website, and on the front page there's a banner for MySpace that you can click, and it goes to the Thelema Coast to Coast site. And then lastly, of course, you can write me. I am still doing the Thelema Coast to Coast sticker promotion, so if you send a postcard to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, at P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, Georgia, 30065 in the U.S., if I get a postcard from you, I will send you a Thelema Coast to Coast sticker, and you can see what the sticker looks like at the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Now, a number of episodes ago, I started listing the number of countries that listeners are in. And you let me know what country you're from by responding to that thread on the forum on the website. So far, I have 20 countries listed that I have listeners from. Those include Australia, Canada, Croatia, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Israel, Italy, Japan, Mexico, New Zealand, Norway, Panama, Poland, South Africa, Sweden, Thailand, the UK, and of course the United States. So, if you are a listener and you're not from one of those 20 countries, I would love to hear from you on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Please go to the site, sign in, and respond to that thread in the podcast forum letting me know what country you're from, and I'll add your flag to the country listing. Now, on show 21, the outgoing song was from a band called Asmodeus X, and the song was called Morning Star. That was a CD provided by Latex Records. And on the following show, I will be giving away all of the Latex Records CDs, not counting the Asmodeus X CD. I have three more. And if you are interested in winning one of the CDs, all you have to do is email podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com and put CD giveaway in the subject and your name and mailing address in the body of the email. Today's winner of the Asmodeus X CD is Michael from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. So congratulations to you, Michael, and I'll be getting the CD out to you shortly. Since episode 21, I've received a good number of feedback messages, so I want to read some of those to you. In show 21, Keith 418 and I responded to a listener named Lon, who asked a number of questions, especially asked why so many people speak poorly of the OTO. And obviously Lon heard our response, and so he has written, 93 John, I want to thank you and Keith for taking the time to respond as fully as you did. Show 21, with the whirlwind tour of Thelemic culture, was actually just the sort of thing I was looking for. There was a point at which Keith said something like, if you get the hint that the OTO could be such a wonderful thing, then you really get frustrated since the potential of the thing is so enormous. Why are you screwing it up? That pretty much sums up my reaction to hearing nothing but infighting and criticism. I read Crowley and other Thelemites, and I see a great deal of potential. When I ask what it's like in practice, I hear all the things that have gone wrong. What I come away with is a feeling that there's nothing more than what I'm hearing about. I understand what you mean by balancing out the nicey-nice. My magical name derives in part from my own tendencies in that direction, but until show 21 and the mini interviews, I hadn't heard anything except that. So thank you, John and Keith, for showing me more of what the OTO is. Keep up the great work, 93 Lon. Well, thank you, Lon. I appreciate the feedback. The next email is from a listener named Jason. He is less than thrilled with some of the conversations I've had with Keith 14. He writes, "Hi, just started listening to the podcast. They have been by far the best I've heard on the internet. The interviewing skills are exceptional. The pace of narration is perfect. Everything is done in a way that holds my interest. However, when Keith 418 comes on, aka Chicken Little the Sky is Falling, I have quickly learned to fast forward until I no longer hear his voice. I completely understand the valid points that are trying to be made through his appearance on the show. However, the reason people like Keith 418 never become natural leaders is because no one wants to follow constant petulance. Throughout his diatribe, he must say the word problem 800 times per podcast. People are not blind. Any man can point out problems, but where are the solutions? The conversations come out sounding like a Jerry Springer show monologue. Issues can be discussed in a more structured way. This is a problem. Now here are my proposed solution. Let's set this thing in motion. Again, everything else is exceptional. It's just this Keith 418 guy. Forgive me if this has already been discussed. I'm only into the sixth podcast. Jason." Well, thank you, Jason. I will make sure I forward this on to Keith, and perhaps he'll want to respond. The next one is from a listener named Red. He said, "Hey, I want to let you know that I enjoyed the show on 2-12-06, number 20. I had no idea that Wicca may have been spawned by Crowley. Love, Red." Well, I'm glad you enjoyed that. The next one is from a listener in Japan. "Hello, John. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Love the podcast and have been listening since the beginning. I always enjoy the content and appreciate the effort it takes to provide this service to the Thelemic community and others as well. We here at Nihil Lodge in Tokyo, Japan, are having an upcoming lecture with Lon Milo Duquette later this month, and I was wondering if you could possibly mention it on your next episode. I know there are lots of non-OTO people here in Japan who listen to your podcast, and we would really appreciate the exposure that a mention on Thelema Coast to Coast would give to this event." Well, consider it mentioned. In any event, we have English and Japanese flyers for the lecture with Lon Milo Duquette available at the Nihil Lodge website at www.otojapan.com. If you could just give us a mention on your show, all of us here at Nihil Lodge would really appreciate it. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work, as well as the great work. Loves the law, love under will. Consider the lecture plugged, and I hope the listeners in Japan will support Nihil Lodge in Japan and go to Lon Milo Duquette's lecture. I can honestly say every lecture I've ever gone to of Lon Milo Duquette has been excellent, funny, informative, and highly recommended. Now we move on to another one. This one is from a listener named Dewey. He says, "John, hello from the UK. Not a Thelemite, but a first-degree Wiccan interested in the broader occult world. Have so far caught up with episodes 1, 2, 20, and 21, and catching up with the rest. Just wanted to say thanks for hosting a serious podcast about occult matters. Podcasts have yet to take off in a big way over here in the UK, and it's good to see that people are choosing to produce podcasts on the subjects that I'm interested in. Thanks particularly for the interview with Bishop Greenfield about the origins of Wicca. Would like to assure the commenter on the last podcast, 21, that there was at least one Wiccan out here who can listen to such commentary in a clear, understanding, rational manner. Keep up the good work. Dewey." Well, thank you very much, Dewey. And perhaps you'll also like the upcoming lecture on this show. I again have Bishop Greenfield, and he's going to be talking about the roots of magic in a Western ceremonial context. This is, and his discussion will be from a lecture that he gave at William Blake Oasis, but I will get more into that in a few moments. The last email I have is from a listener named William. He says, 93 John, this is William, a member of New Eon Camp in Florida. As an aside, I want to say hello to my friends at New Eon Camp, especially the Master Rick, who is a very good friend of mine. William continues, the Lima Coast to Coast really is a great thing, and I look forward to each episode. Thanks for the hard work you've put into it. Take care, William 93. Well, thank you for the kind words. Next time I'm in Florida, maybe we can get together. Okay, so that wraps up the feedback for this show. Again, I want to encourage all listeners to send me feedback. It is really the feedback and letting me know how the show's going and what you all like that keeps the podcast coming and keeps me in tune with what you all like and do not like. So thanks for that. And as you can tell by some of the feedback, it doesn't always have to be positive, saying things are great, etc., etc. You can give me feedback and say what you liked and didn't like. So what guests were good and which ones you didn't like and which ones you'd want back and so forth. So please keep it coming. And I especially want to encourage people to call the listener line at 206-337-0888 and leave voicemail messages there. The audio feedback is especially appreciated since this is an audio program. Now, the lecture, as I said earlier, is from Bishop Alan Greenfield. This is a lecture that he gave in mid-November 2005 at William Blake Oasis. I want to say thank you to Carrie and everybody else at William Blake Oasis who made the recording possible. It was done at a last minute, and I know there were some logistical difficulties in doing it, so I really, really, really appreciate them pulling together and getting the recording done. Unfortunately, though, because of the logistical issues, the recording was done with what seems to be an omnidirectional microphone, and so it does pick up a lot of the background noises of cars passing and things like that. And also, it appears that there was a sleeping dog through part of the lecture, and you can actually hear it snoring in the background. So I apologize about that. I've tried to clear it up as much as I can, and if I did any more noise removal, it would end up having a lot of distortion. So that's about the best I can do. And since the lecture was about 5 months ago, I asked Bishop Greenfield to come on the show briefly to give a bit of an intro and let us know what has changed since he did the lecture back in November. So here's the brief intro, and then we'll get right into the lecture.
Alan, welcome back to the podcast.
I'm always delighted to be here, John. It's always a pleasure.
Your lecture that I'm about to play is from mid-November in 2005. I wanted you to have a chance to update us with anything relating to this lecture since it has been a number of months since.
Well, the subject matter is isolating a particular period of history in occult circles, and since there are so few occult historians of at least serious ones, that I do try to confine myself to a particular orb or perimeter in any given case. This is coinciding with my book, The Roots of Magic. It confines itself to the period 1700 to 2000, and you'll pretty well hear in the talk a discussion of that period. I also try to bridge the vast difference between what I call both sides of the ghetto wall, that is, the magic and occultism in the Jewish community inside the literal ghetto of the 1600s, 1700s period, and the more generally well-known magic, which certainly was influenced by the Judaic magic that we would just consider, let's say, general European occultism or Western occult tradition, so-called. Since that time, in preparation, and now about to be published, if indeed it hasn't already from my publisher, is the heavily revised, and I might also say far better laid out edition of The Roots of Magic. And The Roots of Magic dwells on the period 1700 to 2000, but in the revised edition we also include some very significant new material concentrating on the recent past and specifically concentrating on the nature of the OTO and its future and how it relates more generally to the occult tradition. And of course, that impacts directly on your underlying theme of Thelema.
Excellent. Well, with no further ado, I will lead into the talk that you gave at William Blake Oasis in mid-November 2005.
Hope you all enjoy it.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to William Blake Oasis OTO in the D.C. Baltimore metropolitan region. We would like to welcome this evening Bishop Tao Allen Greenfield from Atlanta, who is going to talk to us this evening about the history and prehistory of the OTO.
I want to start out by saying that magic, and ritual magic in particular, has a very, very odd history. I think history is very odd anyway. You have this situation where historical events, if you've lived through a few, and I've been around long enough that I have, get remembered in 5,000 different ways, even in the lifetime of the people that they happen in. And that's ordinary, mundane history. Now take that and add to it that you're dealing with the history of secret societies, quote-unquote, whatever that may be. And they're actively trying not to leave too much in the way of a historical trail, or at least not an historical trail that is other than what they want to be out there. And the further back in time you go, the more difficult it is to really know what is and what isn't, because for one thing, there isn't much of a paper trail. I, for the last 15 years, followed the rule of thumb that you attempt to get to the essence of what my friend John Sellers calls the authentic tradition. And where you find that, you're likely to find a trail of thought, of unique ideas that help you to sift out what is essentially experimentation, con games, and everything in between to the authentic magical tradition, which I believe the modern OTO to be an integral part of and descendant of. I have worked my way backwards through my books and other writings to 1700. My current book, The Roots of Magic, deals with the period 1700 to 2000, and that pretty much covers the immediate prehistory of the OTO and the history of the OTO as presently constituted. I should say that anything that I say about the history of the OTO specifically is, although I am a Grand Lodge officer, I'm not speaking for the OTO. In fact, if you read the official current history of the order, you'll find several fairly profound differences between what I think is the case and what the U.S. Grand Master thinks is the case in his interesting history of the order in modern times. I'd like to work forward for purposes this evening from the 1600s on. Prior to the 1600s, there was a very, very interesting disconnect in the Western ceremonial magic tradition. I call it looking at things from both sides of the ghetto wall, because that's exactly what it was in some places and sort of what it was everywhere. Generally speaking, what's considered to be the Western ceremonial magic tradition today is what was going on the Gentile side of the wall in Europe. That includes a lot of things that are sort of second and third hand Kabbalah and things that are considered to be quote Jewish or Judeo-Christian magic, but is usually either spurious or sort of from a defector and sanitized for public consumption. There was an entirely different tradition going on in the ghettos of Europe, and Jewish magic and non-Jewish magic up to the 1600s were living independent lives. There was a lot of intrigue, one about the other. Mostly non-Jewish people of a metaphysical bent were intrigued by these mysterious people that muttered in ancient languages and perhaps had some ideas that they didn't know about. There wasn't much interest on the other side of the ghetto wall because they were very insular. There were reasons it was called a wall. They basically lived an autonomous life and didn't, for all intents and purposes, didn't know they were in Europe. But the entire history of that period can be capsulized by saying that if you see something that says that it's the grimoire of King Solomon, take it with a grain of salt. It was a good way to sell manuscripts at that time to claim that this is the secrets of the Jews. It's sort of like Secrets of the Gypsies 100 years ago. It was very popular, and usually by people who had only this most scant knowledge of what gypsies were all about and what magic or non-magic or con game, as the case may be, they were involved in. In the 1600s, there was a resurgence of interest in magic in Europe in general, in part spun off by the Protestant Reformation in Europe. When Catholicism and Protestantism divided, it created wars, revolution, general mayhem, and it also created a new assessment of the magical tradition. It came out as something we call Rosicrucianism, and it had its own mythos, it had its own benchmarks and its own ideas about what that tradition was all about. It had a series of books that came out that became increasingly popular. Whether there were actually people involved in these societies or whether it was just something that a few people that wanted to say something sort of created as a literary device has been much debated. I think they existed at that time. They certainly existed by a century later. They sort of actualized, but my best educated guess is that they existed as an integral group, and they had a lot of astrology, a lot of alchemy, started to introduce tarot, already had some notion of a graded system of initiations, and the central gnosis of magic, which is what I call the core of the authentic tradition, the sexual magic tradition, which was very popular in the East and very much a no-no in Western civilization in general, was deeply embedded in the Rosicrucian tradition by the 1600s, whether, again, this was a few people or a fairly widespread group of scholarly people, I really don't know. We probably never will know, because all we have are the literary remnants. There are no personal diaries or anything available that will indicate anything more than aspects. Just as today, right as I'm speaking, Kabbalah has a wide following. Madonna is always mentioned. And some of us cringe, some of us are happy to see people on board, but a lot of people are suddenly newborn Kabbalists of some sort or other, and there was a similar thing in the late 1600s, early 1700s. And we want to take a look, for purposes of the end of that period, where you have two different magics, Jewish magic and Gentile magic, or to be more precise, Christian European magic and Jewish magic. By looking at the end of that period, we don't have to do too much exploration, because it basically stays pretty much the same from the time of ancient Rome until the 1600s. At the end of that period, while Rosicrucianism is starting to be discussed in certain intellectual circles and certain spin-offs like Enochian magic begin to happen in... and again, I'm using the time period in a sort of loose-knit sense. In Elizabethan England, you have the interest in Enochian magic and in astrology and in alchemy. In other words, as isolated subjects, not necessarily having a lot of crossover. and not necessarily having any kind of organized society being involved. That was just interest fad, like unicorn necklaces. It was the unicorn necklace of its day. During that same period, in the world of Eastern European Jewry and in Spain, notably, which had had technically the Jews had been expelled from Spain in 1492 along with the Muslims, and most of those people found a home either in the Arab world or in the Low Countries in Europe, and you see a lot of Kabbalistic magic and sort of the particularly Jewish magical experience spreading from those centers out into Central Europe and then into Eastern Europe, and indeed into Asia Minor. Had an entirely different type of perspective on it. For one thing, the Kabbalism was good. It wasn't third hand, it wasn't washed out. It was done by people who actually knew what the Hebrew letters meant, not that they were little obscure marks. If you get any standard magical texts from that period, they have these horrible Hebrew glyphs that are totally undecipherable. They look sort of Hebraic, and they're squiggles and bear some resemblance to Hebrew, but not much, and they don't make any sense at all. You had good scholarly knowledge, but no soul in it, because Judaism at that time was extremely conventional. It was a matter of a series of ritual practices. In the 1600s, a combination of a new burst of Kabbalistic interest, along with messianic expectations, began to change the nature of magic inside the Jewish community in Europe and in other places. And that in turn generated several movements which were extraordinarily interesting, pretty much unknown outside of the ghetto. One was the messianic movement centered around a guy by the name of Shabbatai Tzvi, variously pronounced, and rightly so, because it probably was pronounced differently from country to country. Darkly rumored to involve orgiastic rites and all sorts of forbidden things, mostly by Orthodox Jews that didn't particularly like what these people were saying. And having a radical notion that this guy was going to lead the Jews back to the Promised Land. And he indeed eventually came to believe himself to be this messianic figure and relied on Kabbalistic proofs to confirm his divine mission. Well, the movement came to a shocking end because he had reached a point where his following probably included at least a third, maybe half of the Jews of Europe and Asia Minor. He confidently goes to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and says, how about it, King? Let's let the Jews go back to Palestine. And basically the Sultan said, convert to Islam or we're cutting off your head. Whereupon he put on a fez and converted to Islam. Shockwaves all through the Jewish world. Every ghetto in Europe was devastated. Some of these people followed him into conversion. His primary prophet, Nathan of Gaza, became a Roman Catholic. It was a very disillusioning experience. And the Orthodox among the Jews said, well, you see, this magical, mystical stuff is really bad and it corrupts people and you need to stay away from it. And the movement collapsed for a while. Reemerged in the 1700s under the auspices of the next messianic figure by the name of Jacob Frank, who had somewhat different ideas. We'll get to that in a moment. In the 1700s, and this was a gradual process, something happened. You have the Rosicrucian ferment on one side of Europe, of the general magical thing, with these little ideas of something funny is going on among the Jews. They're talking about mystical experiences and going back to Palestine and these Tree of Life things. Nothing like the Tree of Life that you see in the standard texts. That's must be at least 100 different versions of the Tree of Life. Prater Akkad would have liked it. You can't shake a tree without it being a Tree of Life of some sort or other. But in the 1700s, Europe began to change, partly as an after effect of the Protestant Reformation, partly as a result of the opening up of the New World, and partly just internal dynamics, just the way history unfolds itself. Rosicrucianism and its aftermath began to become very, very widespread, had a substantial following, and began to develop some really literate writers and evaluators and practitioners. And there was, early in the 1700s, a kind of a fusion with the then beginnings of speculative Freemasonry, so that Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry pretty much intertwined, and by the end of the 1700s were deeply intertwined. And along with it came this peculiar version of the central gnosis of magic, again that authentic tradition of sexual magic, which probably is the most significant route to enlightenment that magic has produced. Always secretive, because it conflicted with the given gestalt in Europe, which was fundamentally anti-sexual. And the level of hostility and the recent history of witch burning is still very fresh in people's minds, real and imagined, or I should say real or imagined, was sufficient to keep anything that was deviant as defined by the times away from general public use. So it had a certain secretiveness about it. When it got wedded to Freemasonry was already set up along secretive lines for entirely different reasons, probably because of keeping the trade secrets of what amounted to engineering at that time, that is, working masonry. It became a popular rage, first among aristocrats and then among middle class, the emerging middle class in Europe that wanted to associate with aristocrats on an equitable basis. And Freemasonry was, like it is today, partly a lot of fun and shenanigans and partly a serious graded system of ritual initiation, along with a certain amount of Rosicrucianism thrown in with it. In the meantime, back on the other side of the still rather high ghetto wall, a gentleman by the name of Jacob Frank came along and started a movement called the Zoharists, after the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, the great medieval Kabbalistic text, claimed also to be the Messiah, and broached the ghetto wall with a sort of promise to lead the Jews to Christianity. Actually, he had his own agenda, and he switched sides on a lot of things, and so did his followers, and it's quite debatable as to whether anything that he said to any kind of officialdom outside of the ghetto made any was meant to do anything other than keep the cops off his back or the then equivalent. He developed some sponsorship from church sources and royalist sources then beginning to be beleaguered in Europe because it was thought, well, it would really be useful to convert the Jews, and this guy claims to be the Jewish Messiah, which isn't exactly Orthodox Christianity, but if he can lead them into conversion, that'll be a benefit. So he developed a lot of sponsors, a lot of money, and basically he was running a sex magic cult. Some people have argued that that's an overstatement. I've studied such documents as have survived, and that's what he was doing. And he was doing it along Kabbalistic lines, which means that it was both authentically magical and authentically sexual. Because it was primarily confined to Jews, it was also permitted because Christian Europe had an interest in supporting this guy as opposed to the rabbis, who he completely rejected as being irrelevant, essentially. And said that the Kabbalah is the true interpretation of Scripture, and if you understand that, it's sort of a do-as-you-will type of approach to things. Around mid-century, he started to develop organizations that had a euphemism that historians of Freemasonry often miss. The euphemism was Asiatic. And any organization like the Asiatic Brethren or the Asiatic this, the Asiatic that, were in fact organizations that were open to both Gentiles and Jews in a graded system of initiation, usually in the style of the Freemasonry then emerging as a very, very popular form in Europe and in fact in America by then. Had a major influence on the American Revolution, on the French Revolution, on changing the course of the history of the world. And while there was considerable opposition to that mixing of the religions or ethnicities, and there were groups that were adamantly opposed to it, the fact is that Jewish messianic Kabbalism began to make itself felt inside Freemasonry, which was predominantly at that time a movement of Gentile Europeans, mostly aristocrats and upper middle class, upwardly mobile people. But taking in just enough Jewish intellectuals, including some Frankists, some followers of the Zohorist philosophy, that some Masonic groups began to be what we would consider to be proto-OTO organizations. That would notably include the Asiatic Brethren, which one can argue was a direct antecedent of the OTO in terms of its initiatory system. Some of the degrees have the same name. Some of the specific language in the degrees that are given now were present in their degree system. The Fraters Lucas, actually, if you look at OTO credentials from the last 100 years, it identifies itself as the Fraters Lucas, or Brothers of Light, or Hermetic Brotherhood of Light. And in Central Europe, by mid-century, in the 1700s, the two traditions had begun to meld through Freemasonry and through off-Masonic organizations, that is, organizations that were organized along Masonic lines but didn't necessarily have the sanction of one or another Grand Lodge that claimed to be the Masonic organization. Principally, Grand Lodge of England, which still claims to be the ultimate arbiter of what is Masonic and what isn't, which I think is nonsense, but nevertheless is considered to be the case generally by regular Freemasons, as they all themselves. So the authentic tradition sort of fused this Rosicrucianism and Zohorism, maintained in a degree-oriented ritual initiatory system in the type of organization that I mentioned in the latter part of the 18th century. Something resembling modern occult societies, which preserve and present in a gradually unfolding series of initiations. The central gnosis of magic, which again is sexual magic, a term more difficult to define in practice than it is to simply mention off the top of one's head. You see that tradition carried forward in the 19th century in such organizations as the Masonic Rite of Memphis and the Masonic Rite of Mitzrayim, which for a while were considered quite legitimate. And those organizations actually carried over into America, carried over into the 20th century, and actually still exist. Exists principally in the French-speaking world, but there's even an American claimant to it. And it also in a certain sense, the OTO claims legitimately to be the successor to the rites of Memphis, the ancient and primitive rites of Memphis and Mitzrayim, which again contain that same fundamental secret doled out gradually in a series of initiations. In their case, some 90 initiations, which is a little more complex than the OTO system. Towards the middle of the 19th century, an organization emerges which arguably may have had an existence in the Middle East prior to that time. It depends on, I'm not really sure, I'm not decided as yet on this, but it was called variously the HB of L, as it was known during its existence, the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, and a number of other things. It was not primarily a graded system of initiation. It had the three-degree system, as almost all organizations with a Masonic pattern have, ending in a kind of mastership degree. But that was not its primary focus. Its primary focus was to communicate the central gnosis. And in fact, the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, evolves directly out of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light. That's not really disputed or disputable. It claims to be, beginning with Theodore Royce, the second Grand Master of the OTO. Some argue first Grand Master, to be the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light. There are other organizations that make similar claims, but they don't follow a degreed initiatory system, and they certainly do not teach the central gnosis that is communicated within the OTO. That brings us up to the pre-modern period. Official OTO histories say that the OTO was chartered around 1902-03. The old official version, I think, is much more correct. It came into existence in 1893-94 in a meeting between an initiate or acquaintance of the ideas of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, Brotherhood of Eulis, as it was known in America, mostly, by the name of Carl Kellner. And Theodore Royce, who was sort of into any weird Masonic movement he could get involved in, and was a skatey sort of guy, a very mercurial and interesting human being. He may have been a spy. He may have been a royalist. He may have been an anarchist. He may have been a socialist. He may have been somebody who worked many sides of the street. He spent a lot of time in England. He was an opera singer, and said to be a good one, specialized in Wagner, knew Wagner, in fact. And when Kellner, in possession of, I suspect, the essential secret of magic, and Royce met sometime in 1893-94, they blueprinted an organization that essentially became the OTO, as it was through the period until Aleister Crowley became the Grand Master in the early 1920s, which is to say that it took us a series of initiations borrowed from the rites of Memphis and Mitzrayim, which had chartered Royce, took the ideas of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light and fused the two into a system of gradually unfolding ideas about the central core of the magical tradition and what it can do for, to, and with people. And that was the way it was until Aleister Crowley became the head of the OTO in English-speaking countries. He had his own particular wrinkle, which was Libra Alba Legis, the Book of the Law. And he gradually persuaded Royce, the then head of the order, to incorporate the Book of the Law into the OTO curriculum, as well as the central gnosis and as well as the Masonic type initiatory system. The OTO continued to claim to be a Masonic organization, contrary to some historians, until Aleister Crowley's death. the last letter that I'm in possession of from Crowley, dated September 21st, 1947, and on official OTO business, and signed Baphomet 11th degree, is also signed Baphomet 33 degrees, 90 degrees, 97 degree, which is another way of saying Baphomet, i.e. Crowley, head of the OTO, head of the Rite of Memphis, head of the Rite of Mitzrayim, which he claimed repeatedly to the very end of his life. So you will hear from some folks out there that some of considerable eminence that the OTO long ago discarded its Masonic pretensions, and that simply is not true. It claimed until very modern times, and well after I got involved, in fact, 20-some-odd years ago, that it was a Masonic organization teaching a Masonic system, only with this wrinkle that it also taught the central gnosis of magic as part of its uppermost degrees, and perhaps introduced that in subtle ways through various rituals, including its central public ritual, the Gnostic Mass, which it indeed does, if you know where to look. I think that kind of brings it up to the modern era. Crowley takes the helm. Some dispute exactly took, was given, doesn't matter. Took the helm in the early 1920s. And from that point until the 1970s, the OTO essentially, although a small organization, worked in that method. In Switzerland, they continue to work their Rites of Memphis and its Mitzrayim degrees, but to accept the Book of the Law and to communicate the central gnosis of sexual magic. Elsewhere in the world of the MMM, that is where Crowley had the most influence, and here, it became a nine-degree system, essentially, that most of which Crowley wrote himself, and which incorporated ideas from the earlier organizations, the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, the Asiatic Brethren, the Fraters Lucas, the Brothers of Light, and so forth, but which also included his wrinkle on Book of the Law and Central Secret. So you had all those things incorporated into it. Then we come to the modern era. We find certain modifications taking place under the first modern Grand Master, Grady McMurtry, and there have been additional modifications of a sort, some noticeable and some not, mostly of an administrative nature rather than a ritual nature. Coming right up to the end of the 20th century, which is where I will leave this off and open it up for any questions that anyone has. How many of you have I lost? How many of you out there have I lost? Okay, thank you.
No, you haven't lost. I had a question. From an American history standpoint, it seems, you know, it's a predominantly Christian, European countries, Britain, and where the OTO was actually founded. Is it less of a Christian oriented view on, like only on Kabbalah and on the things such as? Is it more of an openness to the magical ideas versus the common everyday Christian perspective of?
It's gone back and forth, and it's depended a lot on the political climate in the external world. First of all, the authentic tradition from around the middle of the 19th century on, in America anyway, it begins to become a Judeo-Christian value. There are as many Jewish influences as Christian influences in it. And there's also a certain ethical monotheistic influence, particularly in masonry at one time in America was every third man. what it was not was integrated by sex or integrated by race, and it still, indeed, to a large extent, is not integrated by race. And I have a serious problem with regular Freemasonry over that. Both of those issues. Women are not admitted, and there's a major dispute as to whether Black Masons are legitimate Masons or not, and whether they're welcome. In Southern jurisdiction, regular Freemasonry, in general, Black people are still not admitted, and Southern jurisdiction is the vast majority of Freemasons.
Wow.
And there are those who would dispute that, but trust me, I come from a long line of Masons, and that is the case. And it's one of the few organizations that still gets away with it. I'm totally opposed to that. The OTO, in fact, one of its first major differences with Orthodox Freemasonry, and by the way, which was preceded by the Brotherhood of Eulis in the 19th century. If you're teaching the secret of sexual magic, unless it's a peculiarly homosexual magic, it's sort of, what do you do with it? Do you take it home and share it with your spouse? Not if it's something that's learned under seal of initiation. Now, they began to... The early OTO was virtually all male. There are some interesting pictures of the Royce era leaders of the OTO, and there's not a single female in it. Nor, I must say, a single non-Christian, non-white, it was a bunch of Germans. And in the Crowley era, you start to get women, because women were a necessity to... Well, women were a necessity to Crowley, actually, but women were also a necessity to the organization, in his opinion. And that was at the same time that the Theosophical Society was pushing co-masonry, which encouraged... They were hoping to actually become Freemasonry, and to replace... race was not even an issue that was brought up in those days, but gender was, and there was a move to... allow women in. But it was not essential, except perhaps from an ethical point of view, for there to be no gender bias in co-masonry. It was a matter of ethics, not a matter of necessity. In the OTO, I would say it was a matter of necessity and was seen as such, if not by Royce, and probably not. He was a creature of the Victorian era, by Crowley, who had an agenda of his own, and clearly, very quickly elevated, I think, more women to the highest degrees in the OTO than men, in fact. And although the OTO was very, I think most people today don't realize how small it was in Crowley's lifetime. Fact is, the membership was predominantly female. Not the leadership, but the membership. And that carried over very quickly to the modern era. I don't know. Did I stray from your question there a little bit? I mean,
that's definitely interesting, and it's along the lines of what I was, you know.
Essentially, you can't really thread out except from accuracy or inaccuracy after. In the mid-1800s, what would have been easily distinguishable in Jewish magic and non-Jewish magic, or Jewish and Christian magic, because there was a definite fusion. Because Freemasonry, even the most conservative Freemasonry in America, was open to Jews and Gentiles. In fact, you see organizations, Catholic organizations like the Knights of Columbus, and especially the Knights of Columbus, desperately not wanting... people to become part of a quasi-spiritual, maybe religious, secretive body that was not Catholic. So the Knights of Columbus was formed sort of along Masonic lines, but specifically for Catholics. The Jews formed B'nai B'rith in America because every third Jewish male was a Mason. And that wasn't a huge group of people in those days, but that was... roughly a million people out of the maybe 3 million Masons at that time. It had its impact, but what you do see in the more magical perspective is you can distinguish between those features that really know their stuff in terms of ancient cultures, ancient magic, and so forth, and those that clearly are mispronouncing words and keywords and signs and certain things that clearly they've learned from the King James Bible rather than from more ancient sources that are more comfortable with Hebraic tradition, terminology, and language, and culture. The two are pretty fused from that point on. By the time the OTO had come along, although Germany in the 1890s was beginning to look like Germany 50 years later, which was not a particularly convivial place for Jews and Gentiles to get together, nevertheless, you do see, in principle, an openness to everyone belonging. In fact, since it's an archaic ritual, I can mention it. The original monarchical degree in the OTO, which is still extant, if anyone would care to look at it, specifically calls for a black person to participate in the ritual. Now, that may sound like from the point of view of our time, deprecating, because it calls for a black janitor. Of course, from the standpoint of the 1890s or the early 1900s, when that ritual was written, to simply have a black person in lodge was, that was stepping way out of line. And in the South, where I'm from, that would have been illegal. To have a black janitor would be okay, but not a ritual black janitor. And in fact, there is a certain office in the current Minerval degree, which I can't mention specifically, which is descended from that role. It doesn't involve race, but the term is preserved.
So that the earlier OTO was more like a gentry class, more, you know, like a more than like a business type person, or
To this day, in Britain, each Masonic organization has some person of a royal, essentially a royal has to be the head, the nominal head of the particular order. That's just the way that it is. But again, there was that opening to the middle class. And by the time it reached America, I mean, there was certainly a lack of popularity for royals. There's a lot of royalist stuff in the OTO that has survived. I often criticize the fact that people take titles like Supreme and Most Holy King literally. And the first time I was at a convention and certain persons who are of sufficient level of initiation, they should know better, start shouting, "Hail to the King, Hail to the King." And I look at my old buddy sitting over there looking slightly embarrassed and figuring, what is he going to do about this? And we had a chat about that, and I don't think we'll be seeing that anymore. We don't have kings here in America. It doesn't resonate real well. I think we had a revolution or something about kings. But as Masonic titles like Knight, which is common in Freemasonry, Prince, Princess, Dame, all of those are used. Some of them fairly extravagant, and even more extravagant than some of the traditional titles in Freemasonry. They aren't taken too literally in Freemasonry, and they probably should not be taken too seriously in the OTO either. I mean, a second degree is a second degree.
Well, I hope everybody has found the lecture from Bishop Greenfield to be informative. And again, I want to encourage everybody to look for his book, The Roots of Magic. I do not think that it is out yet, but it should be coming out soon, and I'll have a link to the press website on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. So, since we have reached the end of another podcast, I want to again remind everybody that Latex Records is giving a bunch of CDs away on the show, and the CD closing out this show is called Electro Age 1, The Awakening. This is a compilation CD with 15 songs. That was the first compilation, actually the first CD put together by Latex Records. And it has a number of different electronic and industrial bands. The outgoing song for today is called Under the Moon by a group called KAJ. And again, I want to thank Latex Records for donating these CDs. And if you want to attempt to win this, send an email to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast. Put CD giveaway in the subject and put your mailing address and name in the body of the email. And just before that, again, I want to remind everybody that Thelema Coast to Coast is broadcast every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I don't know the rest of the times in the world, but you can go to the Circle of Souls radio website. That is circleofsouls.net. And right before the closing music, I have a little reminder about the Circle of Souls show, something that those guys put together and I think is pretty funny, so I thought you all enjoy it. Until the next podcast, love is the law, love under will.
Well, the podcast is almost over. Now what are you going to do?
Look for porn.
See, that's what you get when you raise your child to be a pagan.
You son of a... Your mom sucks!
All right, you two, that's quite enough.
I'm sorry, was it the pagan remark?
Actually, it probably was, but you can make up for it by tuning into Circle of Souls Pagan Radio.
Kick ass!
Yes, it does. Just surf on over to circleofsouls.net. Circle of Souls Pagan Radio.
Reflecting brightly, your presence seems to excite me. I feel your warmth within. Under the moon, pleasure burns inside me. Moonlight seems to guide me. God would see how to say. Nice and slowly, a cool breeze takes me in. Pleasure still controls me, chills cover my skin. Under the moon, your fingers grip with passion. Your eyes control my vision. I'm under your spell. Our thoughts combine emotions.